Hi, you are now listening to a sermon from Harvest Community Church in Hoffman Estates, Illinois. Today you will hear a sermon from Pastor Dave Lee, so without further ado, here he is.
This morning, I'm going to start a new sermon series, and in order to set it up, I want to just tell you a quick story. And I don't know if you guys could jump ahead to the picture of the fountain that's maybe like slide number 6 or 7. One back. Oh. What? Is this thing? There it goes. Oh. Okay. All right. We got it. So in 2021, Zoe and I were part of a small team from Harvest and ICC that did a scouting trip to Albania to see if this could be a ministry field for us. And on the way back, we had a 24-hour layover in Rome. And so we're not going to sit in an airport hotel for 24 hours. We popped out into the city, and we did this blitzkrieg tour of the city of Rome in 24 hours. One of the stops was Trevi Fountain, and I shot this photo there. This is the non-Instagram side of the Trevi Fountain, where you see the crowds. And I noticed that everyone was throwing coins into it. And when I looked in the water, if you look at the next slide, it was just filled with coins. In fact, so many coins are thrown into the Trevi Fountain that they have to collect them twice a week so that it doesn't clog up everything. And they gather about 1 million to 1.5 million euros every year in coins thrown into this fountain. And I remember seeing that and thinking, isn't it strange that whenever you see any little bit of water, it's pretty likely, even if it's just like in the foyer of a Chinese restaurant, and there's this little water feature, you look inside, there's coins in there. I'm like, why is it this thing that we do, that we just throw coins into standing water? What is it about that? And I realize every time people throw the coin into the well or into a fountain, they're making a wish. And it's become a sort of mindless tradition. But if you look back at the history of that practice, it has its roots in pagan worship, where the early Europeans believed that spirits dwelled in moving and still water, places like ponds and streams and wells. And so they would throw coins in as a way of accompanying their prayers with offerings so that the gods and the spirits who inhabited the waters would grant them what they're hoping for. I don't know if that's what people have in mind every time they throw a quarter into the Chinese restaurant lobby fountain, but it just reminded me how many things we do that we don't even know why we're doing them. They start to become practices and traditions, and we do them and lose sight of the original meaning. I share that story because it occurs to me that I've been coming to church literally since I was born. My parents have carried me to church from the time I entered the world, as many of you have. And I've been going to church and leading church services for decades. And some of these things are so familiar that we can do them in our sleep, and sometimes we do. One of the bonuses of the bright lights in my eyes is that I am less aware of how many are sleeping during the sermon. That's good for you guys. You can get some rest if you need to catch up. But I was thinking, like, we should have an idea, some clarity and conviction about the things we do when we gather together. And so I'm going to start a new series called Gather. Oops. I am running ahead of you guys. And the idea is, as we get together Sunday after Sunday, why do we do the things we do? Have you ever wondered why we do some of the things at church that we do? I mean, think about how strange an act prayer is. You just close your eyes and speak out loud about things that are on your heart. If you don't understand the meaning and significance of these things we do, they just become empty rituals. And so my hope as we go through the anatomy of a church worship service is that with these practices that are so repeated, they're becoming familiar, you begin to understand why each piece is woven into what we call worship, and it starts to take on a deeper meaning for you. the passage and the message I want to bring today is what we call the call to worship. It's what starts out every church service. It's how Evie led us into the time of worship by framing our minds around seeing the nature and the character of God through Scripture. And the word that I seized on when he showed us that little diagram was worthy. I want to draw from this beautiful passage, Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. And I want to explore what it means that God calls the people together to worship him. This is a vision that the prophet Isaiah was given, and he's recalling this vision. It was the day that he received his call to ministry. Something profound happened to him one day while he was attending the temple, and he saw something he had never seen there before in the supernatural realm, and it changed him forever. It shaped his whole life. Here's what the passage says. This is his recalling of the vision he was given by God one day when he went to church. The year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. And the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook, and the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hands a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here I am. Send me." Isaiah is given a vision in a place that's so familiar. And the vision, and I want to share three elements of this vision that are so important. They come in an important sequence. If you're going to have a vision of God, a vision that moves your life, that drives you to worship, it should happen in this sequence. And the first vision he's given, sorry about that, is an upward vision. In the year that King Uzziah died, he says, "I was given a vision." And he was likely in the temple that Solomon built. I don't know if you've read the accounts of Solomon's building of the temple. The temple that it was destroyed when a foreign nation invaded. They tore it to the ground, and a new temple was built to replace it, but it was never the same as the original glorious temple which Solomon built. It was a magnificent structure, so beautiful that people would travel from other countries just to look at this house of worship. I remember once when I was visiting Willow Creek to meet with a pastor there, I just happened to see a group of people with a tour guide who had a stick, and he was walking through the lobby giving them a tour of Willow Creek's lobby. Like it was a tourist attraction. I thought that was hilarious, but it is an impressive building. They have escalators and they have a water feature. And so it's a place worth visiting, and people do travel from afar to see this modern cathedral called Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington. Isaiah's in this beautiful place, but when you go to a place enough times, even a magnificent structure is like, whatever. I remember walking through Rome and just gawping at everything. I'm taking pictures. You know, in Rome, you could literally just take your camera and shoot randomly, and every photo is still worth looking at. It's such a ridiculously beautiful city, but to the people who live there, they're like, "Yeah, that's the pharmacy. Why are you taking a picture of our pharmacy?" I'm like, "Because I've never seen a pharmacy that looks like that." Isaiah's in this place where he goes all the time. And yet one day, in this familiar place, he's given a vision where the veil between the natural world and the supernatural world is ripped open, and he sees what is really going on in that place, even as he goes through the familiar motions of praying and worshiping and teaching and listening. He says, this is really what's happening in this space if you had eyes to see. And what he sees is he's at the feet of the giant throne of God that fills this cavernous main hall in the temple that Solomon built. And I remember the first time I visited Washington, D.C. in eighth grade, and I went to the Lincoln Memorial. I was even shorter than I am now when I was in eighth grade. And I remember looking up at the feet of this Lincoln Memorial and I had this really weird sense of first, that makes me uncomfortable. It's almost like he was the king of America sitting on a throne and we're worshiping him while he just sits up there. But I remember thinking, I'm so small and this dude is so big that all I really saw was his feet. And years later, when I came across this passage again and again, I would always think back to the feeling I had the first time I visited the Lincoln Memorial. And even though that statue seems so big, have you ever been to Lincoln Memorial? It's a pretty huge space. The main hall of the memorial is slightly bigger than the main hall of the temple that Solomon built. But if you look at the picture, that giant statue is dwarfed by the cavernous space. And yet what Isaiah says in his vision is that God so filled the space that all he could see was the train of his robe. It just filled the entire space. Remember, this is a vision. But in this vision, symbolically, what he's saying is God was so great, all I could discern was the edge of his garment. God is so vast that he's sitting on the floor and he's looking up at God's feet seated on the throne. And he's just, he's awed by the scale, the enormity of God. And then he says above him were the seraphim. Seraphim is a word used only once in the entire Bible in this passage. It's a Hebrew word that means, literally translated, burning ones. Burning ones. It meant that these beings were so bright, so luminescent, that Isaiah, in his struggle to describe things that no one had seen before, he's trying to say, I wish you could see these beings. And he just called them burning ones because they shone with radiating light. And as he looked at these creatures, they had six wings, and they were covering themselves up with four of the six wings. You still need two to fly, so it's nice to have six. But in the presence of God, they're not flying with all six. They're using two of them to cover their eyes. And why do we cover our eyes? Usually we cover them if we're looking at something so bright, it's hard to look. Have you ever been driving or at the beach and you're like this to see? Because when too much light is coming in, you can't see. Obviously, when there's not enough light, you can't see. But an overabundance of brightness also blinds you. And these beings who are so luminescent that Isaiah calls them burning ones stand in the presence of God and they cannot bear to look at him because he is so much brighter. And then with two of their wings, they're covering their feet, which is also another reason we cover up, is it's a sign of modesty, right? If you've ever been changing and someone walked into the room, what's the first thing you do? Right? You're not like, hey, what are you doing? You cover up because we're insecure, we're ashamed, sensitive about wanting to remain hidden. There are parts of us we don't want to be seen. But I think there's another dimension to this. You know how like when you're singing in the shower and sometimes you're like, hey, I'm pretty good. You know, shower kind of makes you sound like you're decent at singing. And maybe some people heard you and like, oh, this person's a decent singer. And so you get this reputation in your little circle, that guy can sing. And then you come to a place where someone who's a professional singer is hanging out with you. They're like, oh my gosh, you're a professional singer? Well, Audrey sings too. Sing, Audrey, sing something for this professional singer. And what would Audrey probably, well, Audrey can sing. But if you were to say that to me, you know what, I'd be like, shut up, man. Let's stop talking about how I sing. Because when you're in the presence of transcendent greatness, your little greatness kind of feels shameful. We'll develop that a little further in the next point, but I think these angels represent something important about the presence of God. We're so casual about just walking into church and going, oh, I'm here to show up and I'm going to hear about God like he's just some idea about some old guy who did some great things in history. I think we forget the transcendence, the otherness of this being who we gather to hear about, who we gather to meet. These angels are calling out to each other, holy, holy, holy. That's a really weird word. We use it to mean moral uprightness, like you're so holier than thou. But that's not actually the primary meaning of the word holy. It's a word to say, this is so different from us that the only word we can think of is it's other. It's so beyond our scale of reference that we can't describe him with the same words we use to describe everyone and everything else. And so the word they come up with is holy. He is just not this, not all this. He is other than this. We sometimes think of God as the ultimate stop on a train line that we're part of. There's the bacteria, and then there's the multicellular organisms, and field mice, and eagles, and dogs, and then us, and then there's God way up there. That's the wrong way to think about God. He's not the highest on the spectrum where we're also on it. He is a different scale altogether. Every being who has ever actually encountered God without filter first had terror that they would die. And then they said, I'm struggling to come up with words to describe. Have you ever had a thought or a feeling so deep and profound and powerful, and you're trying to describe it? Maybe it was the way you felt in a moment in a dream. Has that ever happened to you? Or you're like, I had this really profound experience while I was sleeping. But as you try to describe it to your loved ones in the morning, it's almost like human language is inadequate to bring words to what you felt or experienced. Have you ever had a vision in your mind that was so powerful, but you lacked artistic skills to let other people see what you saw? It's frustrating. I think this is the way people describe God. They're trying to come up with words to describe a being who in so many ways defies description. And so we try our best to use the similar words we use to describe people to talk about God. And the angels simply, they don't try, they just go, holy, holy, holy. This God is just not like anyone else. He is set apart, he is different, he is transcendent. And his glory, that's another interesting word in the Hebrew, it's kavod, which best translates to heaviness or weight. When you are in the presence of God, all you can just say is, you feel it. You feel it. He brings a presence, a weightiness that you cannot ignore and is a little bit hard to describe. And then in their exuberance, what they say is that this glory, this weight of God's presence is so great, he fills the whole earth with it. And so what you have on the one hand is this God who is so transcendent, his glory, his presence and weight fills the whole of the earth, but now he's also very close to Isaiah, filling the entirety of the immediate space Isaiah's in. And so here's the tension that we, in knowing God, is this God who's impossibly other and transcendent, but also a God who is incredibly near. And so theologians describe it as there's the transcendence of God, the far awayness, the otherness of God, and then the imminence of God, the nearness. He's right here with us too. And both those things held in tension help us to understand and relate to the God who is revealed in Scripture. And Isaiah is confronted with a vision that captures both. He sees the vastness of God, the greatness of God, how it fills the whole earth, but he's also filling the room in which Isaiah is standing. What's amazing is later on, 740 years later, as the Apostle John is writing his gospel, he says in John 12:41, referring to Isaiah 6, this very vision, he says, Isaiah said this, because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. That's powerful.
that the God Isaiah saw, he's trying to describe in words. How do you talk about him? He's a God so impossibly great and yet so impossibly close and near. And what John says is that tension finds its fullest expression in the person of Jesus Christ, in whom the transcendence of God and the immanence of God collide. And so that you have a God who's infinite and great and beyond comprehension, but now has the form of one of us to be known, touched, heard, loved, seen, even smelled. And then this great vision becomes a multi-sensory 4D experience. And Isaiah feels the foundations of the thresholds of this great building, concrete and gold, shaking as he hears the thundering voice of God who calls. And then he sees and he smells the vapor of God's presence that fills that space. This is all happening on a day when Isaiah just went to church. He's like, this is just me another day. That's how I felt in August of 1984. I'm not sure what just happened, but let's keep going. That's how I felt in August of 1984 when I went to a retreat. I sat in a youth camp sermon, expected nothing, was looking for nothing, and I got whacked by the presence of God. I've never been the same since that day. I've shared this with you many times from this pulpit. If there was ever a day that changed my whole life, it was that day. And that day, I was sitting in such a familiar setting. And that day, I was allowed to see something I had never seen or experienced before. And it marked me for the rest of my life. By the way, if you're sleeping, I'm sorry that that light woke you up. But now we're even. The playing field is leveled. What am I saying about all this? That I think sometimes in the most familiar setting, we're given fresh eyes to see what is old hat to us. Worship isn't a state of mind we generate from within ourselves. It is an irrepressible response to something transcendent. Think about the times that a song makes you want to cry, or a piece of art or a beautiful landscape takes your breath away. You hold a baby and you think, how is this possible that two idiots like us can make a creature like that? And there's wonder. And that feeling of irrepressible response to something great, that is what real worship is. It's not a feeling you conjure up. You don't come to church and go, I'm going to try real hard to get worshipful. You know, I think it's hilarious that you kids call the last night of the retreat cry night. Like, I don't know what that is. I'm actually kind of offended by the idea. Like, you're supposed to be scheduled to cry. You know why it's called crying? Because so often in the climax of the retreat, God reveals himself and the tears come. But then there are some kids who I think are trying really hard to cry on crying night. After I became a young Christian, I remember the last night of the retreat, I'm like, I'm supposed to be really moved. So I would think about really sad stuff. It's so stupid. Worship is not some state of mind you conjure up. It is what just happens when you're in the presence of someone so great, it forces you. Have you ever seen the footage of these young girls at Beatles concerts in the 60s? That's worship. They're actually convulsing with so much emotion. It's almost like their nervous system is overloaded. And it still happens today at concerts when the performer looks right at someone and throws something to them and they have apoplexy and then they freak out and they spasm on the ground. It's a reaction to something, not something you're trying really hard to get to. So I think we need to stop trying to feel worshipful and start asking God to show us himself. Because if you are given a glimpse in this familiar, mundane place that you've sat in over and over, if God peels away this veil between him and us and shows you what's really happening in this space, I think it would move you incredibly. Every once in a while, with relationships with which we're very familiar, we're given fresh eyes, and sometimes happens in the most unexpected times. You know, I've been married to Jeannie for 30 years, and we've been a couple for almost 36 years. I've seen her face over and over and over. I've heard her voice. There's no one more familiar to me than my wife. And that's just the way marriage works. This is like a piece of furniture in your life. You're like, you're always there. There you are again. There you are again. And then one day, though, once in a while, I just happen to wake up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. As I'm coming back, I see in the glow of the nightlight her face sleeping, and I think, man, how did I end up with her? She's an amazing person. She survived a life that should have broken her, and there's still love and beauty that she struggles every day to exhibit. Sometimes I get these emails from Shutterfly or Facebook. Here's a memory from your life 13 years ago. I hate those because it always shows me pictures of my kids when they were little. And I'm like, oh my God. And some days you see that and you have this sharp pang of refreshed love. You're like, that is my little kid. And they can become 28, 29, gross, all of that. And still, you look at them and you're like, you're still my little. And this person who's so familiar, who sometimes so annoys you and frustrates you, and you get this moment, you go, oh my gosh. Sometimes you look at your parents, especially as you get older. This is happening to me all the time. I'm just sitting across the table from my parents while they're eating and blabbering on about, I just think, I'm so, thank you for being who you are. You have been some of the most influential people in my life. And I could have been born to anyone, but I'm so overcome with gratitude. Do you know sometimes the kindness of a friend? Just, I'm driving in the car. Has this ever happened to you? And this little note that someone sent you, or a memory of something they did, and you're kind of seized by it all of a sudden, and you think, I'm so rich with good friends. There are people in my life who care about me, and I care about them. You can't feel that way every day. I think we'd go insane if we felt the full weight of that every moment of a relationship. You feel that for like 5 months in the start of any relationship. But after a while, you go insane if every time you deeply love someone, you feel that all the time. But isn't it beautiful when once in a while, out of the blue, unexpected, bam, it hits you. What a wonder, what a privilege it is that I get to have this being in my life. And I believe that every Sunday service is an opportunity. And not just Sundays, it is a time we all gather together to remember that when we look upward at God, every once in a while, He will pull back the curtain and show Himself to us. And it will bring out of us this beautiful natural response, which we call worship. But I want to talk about how next there's this inward vision, because when we see God as He truly is, by definition, there's a reflection back and we see ourselves as we truly are. It's possible to maintain an ongoing illusion about ourselves, about our ongoing goodness and our inherent nature, until we are in the presence of God, who is truly holy, truly great, and suddenly those illusions are shattered, and we get a brutally honest picture of our true selves. That's what happened to me in August of 84 when I got saved, was that for the first time in my 16 years of life, I was given a clear view of the truth about my heart. Some of you are like, that would be awesome. No, it's not awesome at all. It's devastating to see the truth of yourself. It's devastating to see what you're capable of. To this point in the vision, Isaiah has been rendered speechless. He hasn't said a word. Now he speaks his first words, and to our surprise, they're not words about God. He doesn't say, oh man, God, you're so great. All he says is, woe is me. Do you know what that is in Hebrew? This is awesome. It's the word oi. Oi. I think that happens when we encounter someone who is truly transcendent above us. You know, most of my life, I live around normal-looking people. Like us. But once in a while, as you walk through life, in a shopping mall, on the beach, in some other place, you see someone of such nearly flawless physical attractiveness, and you just go, this is not even a romantic, you just go, wow! So that's how good it can get. I just forgot. Because I walk around normal-looking people most of the time, I feel kind of average, like, yeah, I'm like a, maybe a six. Not right at the median, but maybe one notch above so I could have some self-esteem. And then I meet this person and I go, I am a toad. I'm hideous. I forgot that the measuring scale goes that high up and I thought I was like here and then I'm suddenly cast to the sub-basement. If the physical appearance of a human being can make me feel like that, how is it possible in the presence of holy God to maintain illusions about your inherent goodness? How is it possible to maintain optimism about the goodness of people? Do you not study history? History is it's an unerring record of the atrocities, the darkness of human nature. There's beauty there too, but don't make any mistake. Ask any police officer if human beings are inherently good. How bad it can get. What darkness lies. And don't even look at other people. Look at yourself, the things you've wished for, thought about. The strength of emotion when you're at your worst and the things you've wished or fantasized about upon other people. Can we really maintain this illusion that by and large you're decent people? We are not. I don't think we're the worst of the worst, but that's because we're comparing ourselves to the other average Joes around us. I'm okay, you're okay. Until God walks in the room and suddenly you're like, oh, none of us are okay. I'm unclean. This is the first realization Isaiah has in the presence of God is, I thought I was decent. I'm here at church, aren't I? I'm at the temple worshiping like a good Jew. I'm doing all the right things. And he sees God and he goes, oh my goodness, oi. I'm unclean, and I'm suddenly aware of it. I lived in Tijuana, Mexico, on this little beach camp with YWAM for 1 month when I was in seminary for an internship. And the only watch I brought with me was this fake Rolex diver's watch that I bought on vacation somewhere. It stopped working the first time I dipped it into the water, so it wasn't real. But I had khaki shorts, a polo shirt. I was dressed like an American. And on the Mexico side, when we went to the slums to do ministry, I looked like a millionaire. The water wasn't very good there. I literally bathed once a week over the course of that month. But what I liked to do on my downtime when I wasn't serving was walk across the border and hang out in La Jolla, California, just to sit on the beach and watch the dolphins jump out of the water. I don't know if you've been to La Jolla, but it's a hoity-toity community, man. It's not like the slums. It's pretty upscale. And there's this beautiful main street, this drag, where all the boutique stores are. And I was just walking down, like, I'm just, you know, like, I just come from Mexico where I look like the rich guy. And I saw women pulling their children closer as I approached. Some of them crossed the street, like, what's going on? And I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. And I'm like, oh, I look rough, man. In one context, I looked okay. In another, I hadn't changed my appearance at all. I was suddenly made to realize what I actually looked like. I would have crossed the street too. I think you cannot maintain this idea of our inherent goodness in the presence of Almighty God. As long as you block God out, you can. If you compare yourself to the other roaches on the world with us, sure, you might be the roach with the most beautiful antennas. But the minute God steps in the room, everything changes and you're suddenly given a different measuring rod. And then you see, oh, this is what purity looks like. This is what goodness is. I thought that what I was capable of in my heart was good until I saw goodness in pure form. And now I understand. Some will see Isaiah's response as overly, excessively negative? Why is he beating himself up? He's not trying to do anything. This is the first response when you see true holiness, is you're by necessity made immediately aware of your unholiness by comparison. I played a pickleball tournament yesterday, and the way pickleball works is you get this duper rating, and it fixes what level you're allowed to compete in. Even if you're better than that level, they won't let you compete. So I was playing in a 3.5 to 4.0 tournament, and we beat up on a lot of people, came in second place. And then as we were getting ready to leave, I was feeling pretty good about myself, and then the 5.0 players came to warm up for their tournament, and I was like, I quit. I didn't want to play the game anymore. I just got done beating up on beginners, and then I saw the pros, and I was like, oh, I get it now. Who you measure yourself against has so much to do with the way you see yourself. And as long as you keep measuring yourself against other people, you'll come out okay. But it isn't until you enter the presence of God that you're allowed for the first time to see the truth that we've been hiding and running from. And we think that we have to hide and run from it because there's nothing to be done. And God says, come to me just as you are. I can handle it. I've got something for you, but you can only get from him what he's offering if you admit who you are. But as long as you're in denial, there is a barrier between you and this God who you can worship. And Isaiah is made to understand that he is unclean. Why lips? Why not heart? Why does he say, I'm a man of unclean lips? I think it's because he just heard this room full of angels chanting, holy, holy, holy. And he sees God without filter. And there's something in him that wants to join in the chanting and cry out with them, holy, holy, holy. But he realizes in the moment before he's about to do it, I don't deserve to say these words yet. They can say it. They're burning ones. They radiate light. But I see myself and I dare not say the same things that those people are saying. And so he says, I am a man of unclean lips. And so is everybody that I know. From the least to the best, we're all messed up in comparison to the beauty and the purity of God. And as soon as he realizes that, most of us would expect God to say, so Isaiah, clean yourself up. You're a mess. Look at your filthy lips. You don't get to praise me. Instead, what God says is, as long as you can acknowledge that, you don't have to clean yourself up. God will do it for you. The only requirement to receive the mercy of God is to acknowledge you need it. And the person who refuses to acknowledge that and says, I'm okay, don't worry about it, I'm fine. You know, it's my habit. Whenever someone says, can I help you? I have this independent spirit that always goes, no, don't worry about it, I got it, I got it. I'm learning more and more to say, yes, please, help me. Just to train my heart to stop acting like I don't need anyone. The only thing required to receive the mercy of God is to acknowledge that you need it. And so one of the seraphim flies down, takes a burning coal out of the altar. This is all a vision, so these are symbolic things. And he touches Isaiah's mouth. He says, with this touch, you don't have to clean yourself. God has taken care of your uncleanness. The thing which you were insecure and shameful about, God has now made glorious and clean. This foreshadows what Jesus would do for us one day. The beauty of the Christian faith is it doesn't tell you, you suck, do something about it. That is the core message of every other major world religion. You're terrible, you're lost, fix yourself. Only Christianity says, stop trying because you can't do it. Let me fix you. How much would you pay a doctor if every time you went to him, he said, I don't know, just try to get better. That's why I thought I came to you. That's why I'm paying you the big bucks. Make me well. And God says, as long as you can admit you're sick,
got the cure. Once we've seen the upward vision, and once we've seen the inward vision, and it has to happen this way, I see God, and then suddenly, I truly see myself. And when in that place, we open our hearts and God takes care of the problem, then and only then can we do what Isaiah did. And this will be the shortest point, is this outward vision. Because the glory of God, the love of God, the transcendence of God can often start and be seen and experienced in church, but it's not supposed to stay here. I think we all know that, that what we experience of God in this place or among one another is always supposed to break out into the world, but we're too quick sometimes to run out to the world and try to fix it. Ask anyone under 20, what's your vision for your future? I want to change the world and make it a better place. Awesome. But I want you to know that before you can do that, something has to happen in us. We're too quick to be optimistic about the change we can make in the world. The truth is that before we could ever become workers for God, we have to be worshipers. It's in the place of worship that what is wrong is made right, and our hearts begin to get proper orientation. Let me close with just reading the last verse of this. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, and this is God wondering out loud, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And only now, having worshiped God and seeing his true condition, and having that true condition addressed by God's mercy, only then is Isaiah able to say, I'll go. I think the problem with so much moral failure in the church is that people were too quick to volunteer themselves to do the work of God before they made sure that they would remain lifelong worshipers of God. I pray for myself and all my colleagues who are in ministry vocationally that before we ever talk about all the work we've done for him, we'll remain humble worshipers of the living God. Seeing his greatness, his worth. Worship team, you guys can come up. I'll leave you this parting thought. The word worship is derived from an old English pair of words that translate to worthyship, worthship. Worship is a way of seeing the worth of God and then declaring it. I think it's sad that the people who are important to us, we acknowledge only on rare occasion. Once a year, on your birthday, you get to be the special person, and everyone in your life acts like, it's awesome that you were born today. We're going to ignore you after today for like another 364 days. But for today, you are the star. On the day we get married, if we get married, everyone we love shows up, and they treat us like movie stars for a day. And then on the day that we die, all the people who filled our lives show up after we're gone, and they remember us and say nice things about us. These people mean so much to us, but it's strange that we so rarely acknowledge them. But God is so great that we gather once a week in the hope that we could remember how worthy he is to receive all things. If we don't get this vision of his worthiness, our worship, our obedience, our faithfulness will start to feel like slavery and drudgery and punishment. Listen to someone describe what it is to bring up a child or to be married, and they describe it only in terms of the cost and the work and the hard times, and you're like, I'll never do that. Until they say, but when you look in the eyes of someone you love and cherish, it's all worth it. Think about how hard it's been if you have children. How hard they are sometimes. and how little reward you draw from them until much later in life. And yet, when you look in their faces, there's worthiness. This is why we gather every week to remember and to remind each other this God we serve is not a dictator. He is the King who is worthy to receive this from us. It's never drudgery. It's always privilege because He's worthy. I pray that from time to time when you least expect it, you'll just be sitting at church mulling over the cloud that is your life, and one day God will just pull back the curtain. And maybe it'll happen at church like this when we're gathered. Maybe it'll happen one day sitting at your desk at home. But I pray that once in a while, God would pull back that curtain and show you what is real. Towards the end of the youth group retreat, a lot of people were saying, I'm a little nervous about returning to the real world from this beautiful retreat where God feels so close. And I just want to tell you, that's the real world. God is very close. He's great. He's near. He is powerful. He is beautiful. He is worthy. At the best moments of worship, when you see God, that is the real world. And we gather every week to remember in this place, that is what's actually happening everywhere. The whole earth is filled with His glory if you go looking for Him. I need to stop talking now, but I'm going to invite you to just pause for a minute and let God continue in His own voice to talk to you. What is it that He's saying to you right now? What's blocking you from worshiping God? Can you let go of it? Move it aside. May the God who so many days become so familiar, like the wallpaper that you see every day, one day when you least expect it, break through and show you what's really happening in His reality. May He give you eyes to see so that worship will not be any longer a thing you generate from yourself, but it will be a response to the God who has shown you His face. When you look at God, may you realize then that every other good love in your life, every other moment of awe and wonder were just preparation for what is possible between you and the God who made you. That one day you would willingly, joyfully give Him everything. And in the end you would say, it was worth it because He is worthy. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, may this God show Himself to you this way so you could live towards Him in that way. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the sermon from Harvest Community Church. If you'd like more information or have any questions or comments, check out our website at harvest-community.org. Thanks for listening.